KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Listen, if you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
With just 2 months to go until they roll out the red carpet, the race for Oscar is in the final stretch. This week on The Business, we'll go into the trenches with two veteran Oscar campaign strategists. But next, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stay close. It's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
I'm joined in the studio by my fellow banterer, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, quite a spectacle at NBC. Leno out at 10 p.m., back at 11:35. We don't know yet where Conan is headed. And we can assume that Jimmy Fallon and Carson Daly are going to remain in place. But this
for
is,
the time being, at least. We all knew this was going to happen, and we just didn't know it was going to happen in quite the same way. And
we couldn't fathom the absolute incompetence of the way that this was started on the internet and proceeded to drag NBC from starting on last Thursday until Sunday when Jeff Gaspin, the head of NBC, finally stood up before the press gathered in Pasadena and basically had to say, we are moving Leno and we don't know what's happening with Conan. This was a revolt led by NBC's affiliates. Jeff Gaspin made it very clear they wanted to continue this experiment at the network level. And unfortunately for NBC, this has just ended very badly. And who knows what it means for Zucker's leadership, Jeff Zucker, the head of NBC Universal, as Comcast completes his acquisition of NBC Universal. So,
well, the question is this a teachable moment? In other words, will NBC look back at this and say, regardless of what the particular circumstances were here, was there a philosophical mistake in trying to do this? I was talking to a producer who's very successful in television and especially so at NBC, and he said, you know, nobody watches NBC anymore to see what's on. People might go to CBS, they might go to ABC, they might go to Fox, but nobody watches NBC. It's like, what do they have on tonight? And maybe this is the beginning of changing that. They could do something that's scripted and original and interesting.
But the other side of that coin, as Jeff Gaspin pointed out Sunday, is that, you know, he ceded 10 p.m. to ABC and CBS, since the two broadcast networks that have programming at that hour, since Fox does not. And they did not, like, capitalize and feast on the corpse of NBC. So this does leave the larger question, and this is another thing that Jeff Gaspin said, can 10 p.m. be programmed with scripted programming successfully, given how much it costs, given the DVR and the fact that people are really turning en masse to the DVR to watch all the stuff they saved up at 10 p.m.?
I guess you could only say that I think they've proven what can't work at 10 p.m. And I think in some ways there are a lot of producers, a lot of writers, a lot of creators who are thinking this is really good news. But as you point out, you know, if nobody's there to watch the programming, nobody's there to watch the programming. And what they're going to replace it with will arguably cost a lot more money.
Well, in short term, this is all back to basics for NBC, as Gaspin put it. This is programs from producers as, like, new talent like Jerry Bruckheimer and J.J. Abrams. And they're doing a redo of the Rockford Files. They're even reinstating the upfront, which they with the presentation before advertisers that they do every May with their fall schedule, which for the last 2 years they had claimed very arrogantly that they were reinventing television and all of this was rubbish and they weren't going to do any of it. And now they are just back to the most fundamental, old-fashioned way of doing business that a network could possibly have.
And but that may not be a bad thing. I think I speak for a lot of TV viewers who say, I'd much rather watch a remake of The Rockford Files than Jay Leno at 10 p.m.
So let us talk also a little bit about the concept of 3D, a more successful idea, and the huge success of Avatar, which raced to $1 billion worldwide in 17 days. And, you know, what I am hearing and have written about is the idea that all these filmmakers are now going, wow, maybe my movie should be in 3D. And, the tipping point has been reached.
Well, and if you have read any of the coverage out of the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, it's been 3D all the time. I'm surprised KCRW isn't developing 3D radio
yes,
where there's holograms of us inside your car. But out of CES, I mean, Jeffrey Katzenberg said that Munsters versus Aliens is going to be on 3D Blu-ray. DirecTV said they're going to launch three 3D channels. It feels like there's huge momentum, and I don't know if it's driven as much by Avatar as it is, you know, Is 3D in some ways the next DVD? Does it create a new ancillary market on top of ancillary markets?
And we actually had a listener comment to our show that we did about the year to come. And this is a listener, Mike Romo, saying, this whole 3D TV thing, it's a sham. You may see sets and players coming out, but who really thinks consumers are going to jump on yet another technology so soon after spending all this money on HD and Blu-ray? I got to say, I think that, you know, maybe the early adopters won't shell out $2,000 for the TV, but I think we know from past experience it's a matter of time before the technology becomes more affordable. And the argument that was made to me actually by an executive at Fox, which is the home of Avatar, and this is all interconnected, is that, you know, as people do have these more sophisticated things and are going out maybe less, splurging on a TV won't necessarily seem like such a dumb idea.
Not at all. I'm already trying to figure out a strategy where I can expense my new 3D TV on the
LA Times
expense account.
But I kind of agree the tipping point is reached and we will be seeing this. And it will become, I believe, a standard. I believe 2D is going, and as John, as you mentioned before, ESPN, you mentioned that Discovery and along with IMAX and Sony are starting a channel, and so is ESPN. And this is in a way, we're not talking in years from now, but months. And
this summer.
Yeah, it's coming.
And I've seen the TVs, and they're not perfect, and some of them depend on, like, are you sitting in front of them? Are you off to the side? Can you cook dinner and watch TV with your 3D glasses? Can you make, like, 3D pasta while you're cooking?
Well, I
don't know how those things
pause,
are going to work out.
You know?
Well, entire families be sitting at the dinner table wearing 3D glasses? I don't know, but I do think it's going to happen, and I think it's a natural evolution.
I agree. Now, let's turn to the question of something old-fashioned. Spider-Man, Sony's, you know, big, important franchise, not going to have the next installment in the theaters, apparently for a very old-fashioned reason.
There's not a good enough script. I mean, in some ways, you have to give Sony props for saying that the script isn't there. I mean, it's been the downfall of so many franchises. They get a release date, they get their pre-awareness title, and they kind of reverse engineer it from their release date. And I think Sony wisely said, we are not ready to go. And even though this movie is more than a year out, it's supposed to come out, hypothetically, summer of 2011, they have said, we don't want to start production yet.
And what's especially striking to me is that Sony, of all studios, has been the one that is always accused of spending too much and rushing headlong and getting into expensive problems. And to me, if Sony has this memo and is going to hold up a franchise that important to be sure that they're not in that situation, it's clear that life has changed in Hollywood.
Well, and I think you could look back at Avatar and Fox. Now, Fox is a studio that whose entire slate for the last, not entire, but the bulk of their slate the last couple of years has been driven by pre-awareness titles, sequels, remakes, TV shows, and release dates. And they get Avatar, an original idea that had a great release date, but benefited from the fact that it was original. And I think other studios are looking at that and saying, you know what, execution is more important than it ever has been, even if it's Spider-Man 4.
And God knows James Cameron spent a lot of time executing that one. And I believe
and money.
That. And yeah. I think that is all the banter that we can muster today, John. Thank you so much. John Horn of the Los Angeles Times, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, yeah. 1998 is regarded as the year Harvey Weinstein largely created the all-out Oscar offensive, taking the low road, the high road, and every little side street in between to win Academy votes.
And the Oscar goes to Shakespeare in Love.
Weinstein and Miramax mounted a major campaign for Shakespeare in Love that resulted in 7 Oscar wins and 6 more nominations. It also paid off at the box office, which bounced up 44% the weekend following the film's big Oscar night. But with the Oscar telecast losing its audience, it's not clear how much the whole exercise pays off anymore. That hasn't kept the studios from spending lots of money on Oscar campaigns. It's a complicated and secretive business, but whatever battle plan they have, the goal is always the same. Get as many Oscar voters as possible to see your movie. That got a little harder when the Academy announced that there would be 10 Best Picture nominees this year rather than the usual 5. To talk about how that changes campaign strategy and give us some of the finer points of chasing Oscar, we have a couple of PR veterans. Michelle Robertson is the founder of the Michelle Robertson Company. She's currently working with Warner Brothers on Oscar campaigns for Invictus, Where the Wild Things Are, and The Informant. Dennis Rice ran Oscar campaigns as an executive at Miramax and Disney, working on movies like Cider House Rules and Chocolat. He continues to advise on film marketing and Oscar campaigns. I don't want to debate the merits that we have 10 Best Picture slots, but I want to talk about how that affects the year. I mean, does it affect, you know, the studios are being asked to spend, and I would assume, on more films, or maybe not. Maybe they have to spend on the same number, but I can't imagine that's the case. I don't know, Michelle, what do you find?
From my point of view, I mean, it hasn't changed. It's like, oh, all of a sudden, we have 3 extra movies that, because now we have 10, why don't we try to push 3 more of our movies? I mean, you normally know when you're plotting out your year, you know what your workhorses or awards films are going to be.
If you look at when the announcement came, which was really in the middle of 2009, in the summer, we were all told that we were going from 5 Best Picture nominations to 10. That means half of the year had passed, and the movies that were released prior to the announcement, it now, I think, gave certain films and their filmmakers and potentially their studios some anxiety because they may never have seen their movie as part of a Elite 5, but maybe there was an outside chance that they could now become part of 10.
A slightly less Elite 10.
That's right. And so now you've got some reevaluation, and for those pictures that didn't have a campaign budgeted, to Michelle's point, you've now got studios that are thinking twice about how they're going to strike a balance between being fiscally responsible and maintaining a positive relationship with the filmmaker who now all of a sudden feels his movie has a better chance of being nominated than if there'd only been 5. So I feel like the timing was unfortunate because it only gave us a half a year to try and scramble.
I was just going to add that the one description that when people ask this question, I call it optimism. You have a new group of people that are optimistic that their film could be one of those. So, you know, the group that normally wouldn't say, great, we made our $100 million, let's go home, are like, hey, we can be part of that too.
I also think now more than ever, you're starting to see those studios that are trying to be fiscally responsible. You've got investors and filmmakers that are putting their own money into campaigns that are supplementing the efforts that the studios
are. Is that so? Boy, I thought that was like the day that pigs would fly, really?
Yeah. No, I think that's happening.
How does that work for you, Michelle? Like, you're representing a film and you've got a filmmaker who wants the film to get a lot of love. And maybe let's say it's a hypothetical where it's, you know, it's a very marginal film, but the filmmaker is optimistic. Do you have to go yell at the studio? Does the filmmaker yell at the studio? Who does the yelling or does nobody yell? How does it work?
You know, normally, you know, filmmakers, you have a team, you have an agent or you have a manager, you have the publicist, you know, and then depending on who the filmmaker is, like if they have a relationship with the people at the studio as well, it's like, did they make the movie with the studio or was it acquired by the studio? You know, you don't just go, hey, let's send her in, and they said no, so now we won't do it. It starts at having the discussion is like, can we have the discussion about having this discussion?
I mean, I've seen some silly things. You guys don't have to say it, but I got a very glossy thing for Funny People. Now, I don't think Funny People's getting nominated. I don't think Universal thinks that Funny People's getting nominated. But, you know, okay, the ego of somebody is placated by that. Or is there a purpose to that?
If one looks at the awards season as an opportunity to improve your financial result for a picture, for instance, at Miramax, there were many times when we would strategically plan our release to coincide with the fall awards season so that if a movie were lucky enough to be nominated, you then could take an otherwise specialty film and cross it into a more commercial marketplace and sometimes even double your box office as a result of significant nominations.
Like Cider House Rules.
Like the Cider House Rules. In the case of Funny People, it's very unlikely that a nomination is going to improve the financial results of that picture. And yet, you've got a relationship with Judd Apatow that you want to nurture.
Right.
You're making like an investment, putting a down payment on their next project.
So you smile and say, yes, it's a wonderful film and we're going to do this. But then you have to stop, Dennis. How do you stop from getting sucked into the party and the special screening and, you know, all of this stuff that gets made up to advance the DVD release party? How can you say no to those people?
Well, I think that requires those who are in charge of the campaigns to sit down and have, as best you can, a reasonable conversation. And sometimes that requires a backbone. And there are some folks in Hollywood that may not have as strong a backbone as they should.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about going for Oscar gold or gold plate, that is so Hollywood, with two veteran Oscar campaigners, Michelle Robertson and Dennis Rice. Now, Michelle, do you have tools in your kit that you didn't used to have? Do you have some new tricks to get the movie out there and in position properly? I mean, it used to be the standard thing. You'd send out handsomely packaged DVDs and everybody, and you'd do the Q&A screeners. We've sort of seen a spate of made-up parties. Like, I gather that there was a 60th birthday party for Jeff Bridges, in quotes, which involved a lot of Academy members and a Willie Nelson performance. And did we have new tools that we're playing with?
You're not necessarily reinventing the wheel, but what has changed is how you respond to different things. I mean, now you have Twitter, you have all the online, you have the pundits. It's how do you work? What's the timing of those? You know, again, it goes back to when are you doing buzz and when are you creating hype and keeping the momentum going and the timing about what you're doing.
You know, it used to be Variety and The Hollywood Reporter, and now there are all of these online sites, and I don't know how. I think I'm hearing conversations about them very aggressively asking for people to advertise and put, you know, those ads onto their sites or into their print publications.
I think from a media standpoint, it's gotten a little out of hand. I mean, I remember where you would advertise in the trades, and that was pretty much it. Then all of a sudden, we recognized that consumer advertising would not only serve for if your movie was being released in the fall, but you could also kill two birds with one stone by also having an Academy ad in the Los Angeles Times. I remember we began to buy 30 minutes of time and create specials, and it would be the anatomy of a hit or whatever the theme was, where if we felt that certain Academy members or certain awards guilds weren't reading the trades, maybe they were reading the Los Angeles Times, maybe they were watching local television, maybe they were listening to National Public Radio, where I just heard an ad or a quasi-ad, since I know you guys don't take advertising, for a movie called Samson and Delilah. So, I mean, there was a shift from trade to trade and consumer, and now there's a shift from broadcast and print into the internet, and it's literally created a minefield of challenges to try and see who's reading it, who's watching it, who's listening to the programming. And at the end of the day, I'm not so sure how effective it all is, because I see two different types of Academy members. They're the passive type that I think are the older Academy members. They may be retired. They go to the official Academy screenings religiously. They can't wait to get their screeners, and they vote primarily with their heart and are less influenced by all of the media and all of the hype that generates the buzz than I think the public at large. And then you've got the active members, who are people like Michelle and me, who are working. And we understand the campaigning dynamics, and we're probably less affected by campaigning than we could be, because we know that it's in fact campaigning.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You sometimes like, who am I playing to here? So sometimes when you're doing those things, it's like, yep, yeah, maybe we're playing to the industry on a certain level, but we're also playing to the people that write about the industry. And it's a cycle.
It is a very circular game that you guys are.
There are almost more people in the media that go on to bloggers and websites than there are end users, and then they get inspiration, and then they write a story in the Los Angeles Times, which may end up ultimately getting read by an Academy member.
Sure.
I think, you know, Michelle was spot on when she said, all we're trying to do is to get on that list of movies that yeah. I want to see. Right. And however you do it, whether it's your trade advertising or your 30-minute special or your internet ad or your 60th birthday party for Jeff Bridges, somehow, some way, it's a real dogfight to try and get on that list. And it's becoming more challenging and it's becoming more expensive. And with the advent of 10 nominations, you now have more movies that feel like they're a potential contender. And as a result, somebody's going to campaign for it, and somebody's going to have to pay for it, whether it's the studio or it's the filmmaker or the filmmaker's investors. Somebody's going to end up paying for it.
We'll be back in a minute with more about the Tao of Oscar War. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. We'd love to know what you think. Write us at thebusiness@kcrw.com or go to the comment page for today's show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking about some of the finer points of campaigning for Oscar with two veteran strategists. Michelle Robertson is the founder of The Michelle Robertson Company. She's currently working with Warner Brothers on Oscar campaigns for Invictus, Where the Wild Things Are, and The Informant. Dennis Rice ran Oscar campaigns as an executive at Miramax and Disney, working on movies like Cider House Rules and Chocolat. He continues to advise on film marketing and Oscar campaigns. Michelle, you mentioned Twitter before. Do you have a Twitter role? If you've got Jeff Bridges, is he now tweeting about his life as a country singer?
There has been people talking about Jason Reitman, and, you know, Up in the Air has done a lot of Twittering along the way. You know, for me, at least, it's not about necessarily the industry Twittering. It's about the people covering it. That's when, you know, as we know with the internet, things catch fire rather quickly, and you're sitting here doing either doing damage control or doing, you know, something.
Well,
you're
is
like,
it like a tell if you have a lot of confidence, you say, Twitter away. And if you have no confidence, you're like, no Twittering.
I think if you're worried about what somebody's going to Twitter, you probably shouldn't have an Academy campaign because you don't have a movie that's worthy of somebody praising it.
I guess that sums it up. Now, let me just go to this question of personality. What about personality? I mean, I can't help but think that Eddie Murphy cost himself in Dreamgirls because he was so surly and complaining about how much he wasn't paid. And I think people kind of got a... And on the other hand, you have personalities like Clint Eastwood or George Clooney who were super popular. Maybe this year Sandra Bullock pulls in a nomination possibly. Is it because people think she's worked hard and they like her? Dennis?
I think that like any awards show, in some cases it's as much a popularity contest as it is anything. I do believe that we're only human, and as a result, if there's somebody that has somehow alienated part of that voting group, it's going to affect the outcome of the vote.
Let's say you have a very prickly, difficult talent, and this talent is losing votes for him or herself. I mean, I know, for example, when Russell Crowe was in contention, he had a publicist who said to him very plainly, look, you better show up, you better behave, you better not be caught doing anything, you better not drink anything where people will see. I mean, do you have to have the lecture these guys? Is that work?
I think you do. I have had specific conversations with talent that either felt that it was not appropriate for them to go out and attend a function or to participate in a Q&A because they never wanted to be accused of campaigning for themselves. If their performance got recognized, so be it, but they weren't going to be seen as a shill for the performance. And I would have to sit down and say, unfortunately, it's a fact of life that the difference between getting nominated and not may be your showing up to this particular press conference. On the other hand, if you've got someone that is overexposed because of either their personal life or something that's occurred in their personal life, you may have to sit down with them and say, you know what, we're going to take a lower profile here. And sometimes you're effective and sometimes you're not. You got to remember that not only are you dealing with the talent, but you're dealing with the talent's representation, whether it's their agents or their managers or their publicists, and whether or not their relationship with their client gives them permission to be honest with them makes our life either that much more difficult or that much more easy.
You definitely have these conversations. You know, you definitely don't take a hands-off approach. It's like, as Dennis said, you got to show up. You got to be there. You have to show that you're interested to a certain degree and that, you know.
Those are the real stories I want to hear when you pick up the 2x4 and say, get out there or I will, so help me, so help me.
And yet, in spite of that, I mean, if you listen to Sean Penn's acceptance speech last year at the Academy Awards, I mean, he clearly said, you know, for all of you that wish I would have been out there more, I acknowledge that. And yet, in spite of his reluctance to campaign, his performance stood out so much that he won.
What a relief that must have been to whoever was handling that campaign.
to the focus people, sure.
Yeah. Here's an example of what we're talking about. There's a lot of Oscar buzz about Monique's performance as the abusive mother in the critically acclaimed film Precious. But she's been very public that she's not comfortable with the idea of hitting the campaign trail. Here she is talking about just that on her BET talk show. Her guests that day were two former Oscar nominees, Taraji P. Henson and Terrence Howard.
Yeah, well, let's talk about what's happening with you right now. You've got a hell
She's
of a campaign in front of you right now.
She's going to blow you away.
It is a campaign.
It's
you
a
are
campaign. It's like
the Obamas.
President. What are you campaigning for, though?
Oh, popular
That's what
vote.
I need to understand.
Well, a lot of people will not have seen your work, even if it's the most stellar of work. Everyone is not going to see it. So you've got to get people to show those 2 hours of attention for the love that you've put into it. So that's the campaign. And I mean, and it's a 5-6 month straight campaign.
It's also really just about raising the awareness of who Monique is, you know, because they're, you know, we have our fans and then there's so many people that still don't know and we need them to know.
We do need them to know. I guess that my feeling is just different in reference to this campaigning because I'm really trying to understand it because President Barack Obama had to campaign because he had something to prove that he could do it. Well, the performance is on the screen.
Right.
So
yes.
At what point am I still trying to prove something?
You say you finished.
And now back to our conversation about going for Oscar gold with veteran campaigners Dennis Rice and Michelle Robertson. Michelle, I guess, do you ever think in terms of aggregating Oscars? Like, is there some such thing as a campaign for best sound so you can claim that you have 10 nominations for a movie?
Sure, you want to be the top of the list with the most nominations. But as part of that, you want to make sure that one nomination that you have is a best picture. So you could have 10 below the line, and that's great. But if you're not getting those big categories, you know, there's only so much you can crow about.
I do believe that there's a certain value in the critical mass of nominations. Now, clearly, from a commercial standpoint, Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Director, Supporting Actor, Supporting Actress, those are the ones that, from a commercial potential, need to be garnered in order for you to then leverage that into the commercial marketplace.
So let me just ask you, the game changes when the nominations are now announced. And I remember, you know, hearing about Ron Howard going to the motion picture home in the hope that a couple of old actors would or Academy members would be there and support the film. And a lot of people making that pilgrimage, not just Ron Howard, but that's the sort of thing, you know, if you want to just doing whatever. Is that still something that people would do, Michelle?
That's funny. I've done it myself, and I was just thinking I haven't done it in a while.
But good idea.
But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, look, this is a lot of what you're doing, too, is like the grassroots. It's, you know, you're not kissing babies and shaking hands the whole time and, you know, please vote for me. But, you know, you do have to, you can't just buy advertising and you just can't screen the films. You know, you got to get out there and let people know that you're there.
And that you want it.
Yeah.
I think that
without there's a balance of doing, there's a way to do it that's classy, and there's a way that can put people off, and you have to strike that balance.
And I think it falls into the leave no stone unturned philosophy, where at the end of the campaign, you can look at your filmmaker in the eye and say, we did everything humanly possible, within reason and within good taste, to get your film recognized. Then you feel like you've done your job.
Exactly.
Michelle Robertson is the founder of the Michelle Robertson Company, a publicity firm representing specialized film companies, major studios, and filmmakers. Dennis Rice is a consultant who has worked in marketing for Miramax and Disney. Thank you guys both so much for a really interesting conversation.
Thank you, and everybody make sure to watch the Oscars this year. Hopefully some of our films will be there.
Yes,
it's our pleasure. Thank you very much.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Darby Maloney is our associate producer. Our theme music mashup was designed by beat architect Jason Groman. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. If you have any questions or comments about the show, write us at thebusiness@kcrw.com. You can also listen to this or any past program and comment about the show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can listen to our podcast, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with the click of a button from our new media player at kcrw.com. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.